You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome to the Here District. The fantastic voyage, following the ups and downs and the exploits of the Milwaukee Bucks this season. Man, it has been one crazy ride, but it's been fun. I'm Marcus Johnson, the captain of this vessel. I'm joined by my son, Chris Johnson, my first mate. Got on that 1995 UCLA National Champions hat, and we're the only father and son combination to win a national championship at the same school. We hold that distinction. And
yes, sir.
So I just want to throw that out there so our guests will know who he is, like, dealing with this afternoon. But no, Chris, this is... this dude here, man, Chris, was George Hill. Welcome, George Hill, first of all. George Hill, welcome to the Here District, man.
Thank you, sir. Us.
The first time George Hill, Chris, came onto my basketball radar, and I shared this with George. He probably doesn't remember. But I was doing games for Fox Sports. We were working at a double hitter in Phoenix, Arizona. Arizona was playing somebody. I think Arizona State was playing Indianapolis IUPUI. Yeah, I'm like, hey, what is that? IUP? I never heard of the school. I mean, you know, I just, you know, Indiana University. What is it, George?
Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
Purdue University, Indianapolis. IUPUI.
Yes,
sir. Did you have blonde hair at that time?
No. I didn't back then. I stopped it. But like, I used to always put like color in like the designs in the back.
Okay, but you had your hair. Something was going on. So this you get this.
You remember back in the day, you put the on your little part.
Yeah,
I like the little colorful chalks in my hair.
For sure. Yeah,
there was something going on with his hair, and I'm watching. And you guys were playing Arizona State. Or who are you guys playing? I'm not even Arizona State, I believe.
So we're out there, I think, playing ASU.
Yeah, ASU was double hitter, and so we were doing Arizona, and so I'm watching the game before that, and so Arizona State, I forget who they had, decent team, whatever. But I'm watching this like this guard just light him up, possession after possession. You know, 6'4", lean, handle, could shoot, just had this. It's almost like the Chris, we were talking yesterday on a podcast we did about these guys from Rutgers that I had no idea how good they were until I saw their mock draft placement as top five, top seven picks. But this guy, George Hill, had this same kind of just impact as a player. He was just dominating. He was best player on the floor, both games. You know, in Arizona, I forgot who they had, but they had, you know, it was Arizona. But George, man, just talk about your career. I know you've shared it with me in terms of kind of growing up in Indianapolis and the kind of talent you guys had in the city at that time. Just give us some background on what was going on back in Naptown back in those days.
It was fun. You know, everyone calls it like New York will say they're the basketball mecca, but I think Indiana will say we're the basketball, you know, state in all states of the U.S. But like, you know, we had talent everywhere, and no matter what team you play for in that era of 95 all the way to now, you always had like a pro on each team in high school, from the Jared Jeffries to the Sean Mays to the Zach Randolphs. Then you had Lawrence North had Mike Conley and Greg Oden. Then you can go to North Central, had Eric Gordon, A.J. Ratliff, Tony Pasley. You had Pike, had Robert Vaden, Courtney Lee, Jeff Teague.
Mm.
Josh McRoberts was up in Carmel. You know, Gary Harris was at Hamlet Southeastern. And then you had, you know, Desmond Bain down south, all the Plumleys, all the Zellers. Can't forget about Gordon Hayward's at Brownsburg. Like
Hoopers.
At Northwest. So like Kyle Guy was at Lawrence Central. So it's like wherever you went, hit inside of, you know, Indianapolis or even the surrounding areas, you were always playing a pro in high school. Well, not just in high school. They just turned out to be pros, but theoretically speaking, you were basically playing a pro. So the competition was always, you had to bring your A game no matter what.
Can you cite a specific reason why the talent level, I mean, it was the grassroots programs, were there really good grassroots kind of youth programs? Were there anything special going on that you can cite or it just happened that you guys have always produced some outstanding talent, but this just happened to be one of those golden eras of Indiana basketball?
I don't think it was just like grassroots area, because some of us didn't play AAU. We didn't have the money to do that and things like that. But I just think, like, you know how they say Texas is a football state, Florida's a football state.
Word.
Everywhere in Indianapolis, no matter what corner you went on, you were going to have a rollout court or a park to play at. Either we're playing in the street, on a pullout court, or we're at a park. And if we didn't have that, we play this game called curveball, mm-hmm. which is theoretically you shooting shots over the street trying to hit the curve to bounce the ball back to you. So we're shooting shots no matter what, right?
Wait. Curveball, you're shooting it off the curve. And you're not shooting at a hoop. You're shooting it. There's no hoop.
It's one guy. No basket. It's one guy on one side, another guy on the other side of the street. And literally, you're just taking the ball. You're like shooting a jumper, and you have to do such good form and art to land the ball like in a rainbow thing and hit the curb. If it bounces back to you, you get a point.
Okay. Wow.
If it doesn't, then it's that person's turn to go shoot. You go to 21 that way. But what people don't realize is we were working on our form. We were working on our distance, calculating things all in one when you really didn't even know about it. It's just no different than if you're sitting at home and you take trash, you ball it up and you throw it in a trash can. Sure. Or when we were kids, we took socks with a hanger and you bent it and you put it on your door and you kind of shut that door and that hanger pop up. You bend it back. You're in your bedroom with a sock, you know, counting down. So I think a lot of it has something to do with the success of basketball in Indy, because everything we did was basketball, 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 basketball. If you played another sport, everybody looked at you like, are you crazy?
Yeah, George, I got a question about that era. Like, what was the disposition of you guys back then as Indiana Hoopers? Like, how did you guys view yourselves versus everyone nationally? Did you have a chip on your shoulder? Was it like, you know, when you went on the AAU scene, did you guys play with something to prove? Break down that for me, if you will.
I would have loved to see if we actually would have got all the guys from Indianapolis
together
or Indiana on one AAU team and play teams nationally. You know, like sometimes you get those teams in Cali and they're loaded with all the Cali talent. Like
facts.
They had eight guys who are pros on a team. Like Indy, we didn't do that. Like everyone wanted to go kind of branch out on their own. So like, you might have one guy on this team, two guys on that team, two guys over here, one guy over there. Okay. We never got to come together and really actually play, but we've always thought that we were one of the best states for basketball, and I think we carry that with us no matter if we were by ourselves or if we were two or three other guys from Indy. Mm-hmm. We just always thought, like, you put us out there and you roll the ball out, at the end of the day, it's 94 feet, or if high school 84, whatever it was, we felt like we can compete with anybody in the nation.
I guess as a follow-up to that, sorry about that, MJ. As a follow-up to that, George, as a senior, you averaged 36 a game. You were out there killing. Was there a moment during that senior year where you knew that you had a shot at the NBA?
Really not in high school, because like the crazy part is when I was in high school, we had Sonny Vaccaro was Adidas at Fairleigh Dickerson, right? And I was pretty much the only Indianapolis kid that was with Adidas at that time. Everybody else was Nike, which was held at my college at NIFS at IUPUI.
Yeah.
But I went to Fairleigh Dickerson, and that was with, you know, that's when Sean Livingston was on the stage, Basson Telfair, you know, Randolph Moores, Robert Swift, Dwight Howard, Josh Smith, J.R. Smith. Like,
yes, sir.
There was so many players, Justin Thurisoli, like the talent level and the pool level was so big. So when I got there in high school, I'm like, okay, well, I'm the only guy from Indy. Let me show you what I can do. And I played really, really good at that camp, but also didn't play AAU my whole life. I only played AAU my junior and senior year on a big market. You know, my godfather had an AAU team when I was in eighth grade, but I was like, basketball was on the back burner for me. I was soccer and football.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I finally got to high school and had to choose one. I ended up choosing, you know, basketball to take more seriously. I played football and soccer, but I took basketball super serious, right?
Yeah.
And so I missed out on that AAU from really my freshman, sophomore, and junior year until like going into my senior year, I played for Shepherd and Sports All-Stars, but like I didn't get to really see that until I actually got there. And I was like, all these guys are going out of high school. I was like, I can compete with them. Like I was in the trenches with them working and competing. And I just said, okay, well, I'm super under the radar right now. Let me just go to college and figure it out. And I told myself, if you give me 2 or 3 years in college where I can mature and learn some new things, I'm going to be a pro.
So now look, I want to get back to curveball because it brought me back to just how inventive we can be, you know, growing up, just coming up with things just to occupy. So I used to do this game in the hallway of my parents' home in South Central George, Chris, where I would cut these two slivers of cardboard off a shoebox, real about an inch, 3/4 of an inch thick, you know, make them into a circle, tape one on one end, tape the other on the other end, go steal one of my mother's plastic grapes out of the living room where she had them on display, little ball, little plastic grape ball. That was my ball. And I'd sit there for hours, like being Chick Hearn and just commentating my own game. John Havlicek brings it up to the right side, pass over to Bill Russell, Bill Russell back to Havlicek, 15 footing, God! You know, I have the crowd knowing, all that, you know. And I'd sit there, my sister thought I was crazy. I'm just playing with my fingers for hours and hours. But that was my mindset. Now I hear curveball, George, is that something that you guys came up with during your generation? Was that just something that everybody kind of grew up playing in your neighborhood? Was that, you know, specific to your neighborhood? Had you known about the game before? Or did you guys make it up? Where did that come from?
I don't know. I think it's a Midwest thing. I don't hear a lot of people from the West Coast saying, or far East Coast, but everyone from Chicago to Kentucky, kind of that Milwaukee area, Wisconsin area, like, know about like a curveball. But like when I talk about somebody else, they're like, yeah, what? Anyway, we would sit there on the side and we'd be dribbling. And oh, if a car is coming by and you shoot it over the car and you hit, it's automatically game. You get to
oh, that's game. Okay.
So you used to wait for it, like pray that a car comes down the street.
Yeah. But
you would go behind your back, you would spin, pump fake, everything like you said, like, oh, crossover, behind the back, spin, pump fake, oh, get him up in the air, foot. When it hits the curb, you're like, oh, you bust your head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just
talk trash.
Yeah, yeah. Your imagination just going, yeah. See, that's what people don't understand is that, and you're developing that competitive spirit. You're developing the hand-eye coordination. I used to do a talk show with Sean Farnham back in the day, Fox Sports in L.A., and we interviewed one day a bunch of Florida football players, and they all talked about racing cars. You know, a car would come down the street, a dirt road, and they'd race the car. And then it kind of connected with me why these guys are so fast. All these guys were just like 4.2, 4.3, 40 guys, but it was all about using what was available in your environment. You didn't have access to the high end training stuff and all the trainers and the equipment. So you had to come up with your imagination, man. Come up with things that you could do. And like you're saying, and when I think about Indiana players, all of them can shoot. All you guys can shoot. All you guys, you know, everybody from Indiana has got a jumper, pretty much, right?
We used to sometimes take, like, you guys have alleys, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes take crates that they used to deliver milk in.
Yeah.
And we will take a saw and cut the bottom part of the crate open and nail it to, like, a light pole. You didn't have a backboard, so if you don't hit that base shot, straight over that pole, it's going to go left to right. But, you know, like, I couldn't afford a basket, you know? So maybe sometimes somebody for Christmas got one down the street, or there was a park 5 minutes from my house. That's where I would play. But if I couldn't go to the park, I couldn't do it in those states. We either play in curb bar or we're in that alley just shooting all netters all day.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's funny because where I grew up in South Central, the original house we lived in, 8821 South Gramercy Place near Manchester and Western, there was a park around the corner, St. Andrew's Park. But I used to always want a basket in my driveway, and we had telephone wires, so we couldn't do it. We didn't do it until we moved up into a nicer neighborhood or whatever. But my point is that even today, when I look at houses, I always look and see if there's no basket in the driveway. I always like look and see, well, that'd make a good court right there. That'd make a nice court. You could put a basket right over there on the side, put it on the garage. But anyway, man, so let's get into you and Broad Ripple High School. That was your neighborhood school, Broad Ripple. Give us you know, kind of a tough school to go to. What kind of environment was that to come up in Broad Ripple?
I mean, Broad Ripple, like y'all watched the movie Lean on Me, right?
Yeah.
that is Briar Ripple to the fullest. If I can like say what Briar or show what Briar Ripple is, if you watch the movie Lean on Me, that was identical to a lot of the IPS schools, not just Briar Ripple, but a lot of our public schools in Indy, you know, all of them were like that Lean on Me type material. So
that was Principal Joe. That was Joe, right? Principal Joe.
Joe Clark.
Joe Clark. Joe, you're right. Right. Okay.
We had our principals, but we were low graduation rates, fights every day, drugs moving around every day. Like we couldn't keep nothing either. Things are getting broke all the time or stolen all the time. So it's like you just had to figure it out. And, you know, they shut our school down and they just reopened it recently, starting from a middle school again, trying to work their way back up to high school. But if you can say what Briar Ripple is, if you can just think about Lean on Me, that will give someone just the best understanding of what school, kind of school I went to.
George, what?
Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
George, were there any obstacles associated with that environment that got in between you and being able to hoop?
I mean, definitely so. You got to think, I come from the inner city, which wasn't one of the worst neighborhoods in Indianapolis, what they so-called say.
Yeah.
So all my friends were sometimes making the wrong decisions, trying to go left while I'm trying to go right. So the thing about that is, how could I always stay so focused? And that's trying to surround yourself, but also not trying to change where you come from.
Yeah.
Word.
So the obstacles was very hard because it's like, also want to hang with my friends, people I grew up with my whole life, but also know that lifestyle wasn't for me. You know, a lot of my family were in that lifestyle and I've seen all the negative happen with that lifestyle. So I was like, okay, I don't want to go that way, but how do I go the right way, but still be cool with my friends? So that was, you know, you lost a lot of friends.
Yeah.
Like they think, oh, you're different. No, I'm not different. I just want different. I'm the same person that comes up in the same neighborhood as you. I just want something different. I'm tired of living that same systemic lifestyle or the struggle. I just wanted something different. So the obstacles of doing that is like, you're always having it in your face, the temptation, all the nice shoes, all the nice cars, the 26 rims, your trunk is bumping every day. You didn't have that.
Was there anybody in the neighborhood, kind of, you know, guys of influence that might have influence you to stay away from that, or did they try to pull you in? How was that dynamic when you were growing up in Indy?
I mean, definitely so. Like, one of my cousins, he passed away now, got killed a couple years back, right before the bubble, actually. He got gunned down, got set up by another neighborhood that was like right down the street from us that didn't like my neighborhood. But like him, and there was another guy, that an older guy that used to be at the park. I grew up at a place called Washington Park in Tabernacle Church. Tabernacle was on my mom's side of town. Washington Park was on my dad's side of town. My mom lived on the west side. My dad lived on the east side, right? Mm-hmm. So I would always normally be at Tabernacle Church or I'd be at Washington Park. But when I go to Washington Park, there was a guy named Terry who was always, he got hit by a bullet, paralyzed from the waist down. I had all hopes for playing basketball, but I remember him and my cousin used to always tell me, like, gee, like, trying to be on the block and trying to sell dope and do all this stuff ain't really the lifestyle for you. Like, they sent me down one time, was like, you literally have a chance to get out of here. You're probably one of the first that has a chance to get out. Don't F it up.
Word.
And I remember my cousin told me one time, he held a gun to my head and said, if I catch you out on the corner, I'm going to be the one to pull the trigger before somebody else.
Wow.
Well, in that moment, man, what was going through your head in that moment?
I didn't know it was him at first because he came up behind me. And it was just a gun and you heard the click, click. And he was like, man, you have a chance because like I could have robbed you right now for whatever's in your pocket. What, $60, $40? Like you really want to lose your life over $40, $60. And he said, if I ever catch you out here again, I pull the trigger myself. You have a chance. Like, if you need something, you come to me. I'd rather you come to me than you be out here. He gave me $300 and told me to go about my way.
Yeah.
But like him and a guy, Terry at the park, like all those guys are kind of the ones that kind of pushed me away. Like, man, you don't need to do none of this. Just stick to basketball because you got a chance. And I rode that way.
Yeah. So here's a quick story. So my junior year in high school, we were ineligible, had an ineligible player. And so we were pissed off, number one team in the city, Crenshaw, but couldn't go to the playoffs. We go to this playoff game, mad, a bunch of my teammates, Reggie Mims and Steve Woods and Kenny Daniels, the guy that got us ineligible. So after the game, they're looking to, you know, and I drove. I'm the one that's driving, George, Chris, my 1966 Ford Falcon. And my father got at a police auction for about $300. So anyway, and so I'm driving. And so after the game, we see these two guys from this rival school, Jefferson High School. So my guys are like, let's go beat them up. And I'm like, nah, these good dudes are cool. I know them from summer leagues. So this other brother that I knew from middle school, Jeffrey Rakes from Dorsey High School, comes up and he's like the peacemaker. Brothers, let's chill out, brothers. So Kenny Daniels socks him in the eye, splits his eye open. They're jumping over, they're over him, about to jump him. I hover over him like, you know, I know him from Audubon Middle School. Leave him alone. They leave him alone. We hop in my car. And here's the point of the story. So we're headed home. It's on the east side. I think we were coming down Firestone Avenue or something, Chris. Hmm. So these Hispanics, about five or six of them, pull up next to us, and we're hot. You know, my guys are ready for action. I'm driving. So the Hispanics pull up, they look at us, we look at them. So my guy, Steve Woods, my teammate in the backyard, what y'all looking at? They're like, what you, you know, so all these epithets are thrown across. So they're like, pull over. They're like, yeah, pull over, SA, pull over, right up here. So they're like, Marcus, pull over. And here's the point. I told these dudes, I said, look, man, I had enough excitement for a night. I said, I'm going home, man. They called me all kind of B words, all kind of P words. I said, I'm going home, man. If y'all want to come back and meet these dudes and fight, that's on y'all. I'm going home. I had, you know, this is, so my point is that there are those moments. If we'd have fought those dudes, if I'd have, you know, been macho, man, let's get out. I might have got shot, stabbed, arrested. You know what I mean? It might have been, so those kinds of moments. In your life, when you're growing up in the inner city, man, you know, it's almost like guardian angels. You know what I mean? And your cousin with the gun to your head, Chris, I know you've had some experiences going to Crenshaw and growing up right where the Rolling 60s kind of started on 60th and 11th Avenue. But George, I mean, any other moments like that for you that you can recall that, you know, that you look back on now and you're saying, man, God had somebody protecting me right at that moment.
For sure. I mean, those are moments, because you have to think, if I were out there trying to sell weed or dope and I did get busted, my career may not, you know, sometimes that one opportunity is all you get, right? And like you said, I could have been out there and he said, it could have been somebody else other than him just want to rob me, thinking, okay, that's G Hill here. I know he got some money.
Yeah.
Right. And I get shot because I was so like, naive and hot-headed as a kid because I didn't trust anybody. Like, I grew up in a rough neighborhood, so it was like you fight your way out of everything. You don't trust nobody, especially the police. Like, it was all these things that's going through your head as a kid because of past experiences, right? And I know me, I would have been like the one, you ain't taking nothing from me, right? And that was that contemplation of like, rather give it to him or no, I'm going to fight my way out. Even if he had a gun, you would think like, well, I don't want to be soft or I don't want to be a P word. Like, I'm going to fight my way out. And fighting my way out is probably some of the stupidest thing because that one bullet, boom.
Yep.
Trajectory of whatever I'm trying to do is gone.
For real.
So it's like those experiences and like you said, trying to go. I remember when my neighborhood got into it with another neighborhood and they want to go. This neighbor came and shot up some stuff and they wanted to go shoot up some stuff. And I looked at myself like, I want to get in the car so bad because they're calling you all the time. Like you said, they calling you P's and B's. you get a soft on us, like, Asian. And in my head, I'm like, I ain't better than those things. Like, I want to go, right?
Yeah.
You start thinking to yourself like, I got a chance to do something. They tell me I got a chance. And I'm like, nah, y'all, I'm about to go over here. And they're like, are you weak? You weak? And I'm like, I'm just gonna be weak today.
Yeah.
I'll be fooling me tomorrow. Like,
pride, right? Sacrifice your pride.
Yeah, but it,
the next day they call me, are you trying to hoop?
Right. It's over with. Yeah.
This neighborhood trying to hoop. Like, you, because we used to do battle of neighborhoods, right? We'll try to go to the west side and go who had the best side of town hooping and things like that. But it all goes by our territory about, but I think like these dying away from those, you can call me what you want to. I think I made the right choice.
Yeah. No, and it reminds me, your life sounds like a movie, George, but it reminds me of that scene in Boys in the Hood when
Ricky
got shot right in Cuba Gooding's character. It was like, let me out. you know, hey, yo, let me out. You know, they were going to get some, you know, to avenge the death and let me out. And you know, in moments like that, man, you just don't know. So, man, I could talk about this stuff all day, man. You ever thought about writing a book, George, or doing something with this? Because every time I talk to you, it's like fascinating listening to the way you break it down.
People have asked me to, but like when you write a book is when you towards the end of your chapters, and I feel like I still have a whole lot of chapters left to live to tell a story.
For sure.
Good stuff, man. So let's go on, man. So Broad Ripple, you got a great story about, was it your great-great-grandfather or great-grandfather?
Father.
Talk about that in terms of your college selection and how that came into play.
Okay, so like I led the state in scoring 2 years in a row in Indy. So, of course, like every college was out there, and I could have chose a lot of colleges, and from IU to you know, the Florida States, Florida A&Ms, the Temples, the Tennessees, to all those places. But my great-grandfather, I never got to meet. My dad doesn't know his dad, and my mom doesn't know her dad. So I didn't have a grandfather. I had a great-grandfather that I was blessed enough to meet before he passed away. And he always used to sit there. My grandfather loved to play solitaire. Like, when he was older, I think he couldn't stand up straight because he didn't want a table in front of him. He wanted to just bend over on this rocking chair and be like between his legs, like just leaning down playing cards. So he literally will just be like this all the time. Right. So he always wanted to watch me play basketball. He was like, man, never got to see you play like in person. I want to watch you play. So I'm like, I know he's getting old on age, like up there in age. He was like 94 at the time. I'm like, if I go far, ain't no way he's going to see me play like in person. Really?
Yeah.
He probably only got a year or two less. Mm. And I was like, if I go to IU as far, and he was getting sick. So I'm like, I know him out of his nursing home, they're not going to let him go all the way to Bloomington and see me play. So I was like, well, if I stay at IUPUI, not only I can start trying to be a hometown hero guy, but I can try to put IUPUI on the map and I can be close to my family and friends. So I was like, it's a win-win for me.
Yeah.
So when I verbal to IUPUI, everybody was like, oh, you're stupid. You pass up all these high Division I offers to go to this mid-major. Like, you're never going to make it. But when they said that, it was like, oh, yeah. Well, I guess I got to prove you wrong, man. I'm definitely going to make it. I don't know how, but I was like, basketball is basketball. You just got to make a name for yourself when the opportunity comes. So I chose that. He ended up going into my senior year. And when he passed, like, my mom and it was like, are you going to transfer, because the reason why you stayed here is because of him. I was like, no, I think things happen for a reason. Like, I'm big on things happen for a reason. So I stuck with it. And the crazy part is we had a scout. The Pacers had a scout named George Felton. I don't know if you know him.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Pacers had George Felton at the time.
Big man, right? Big dude.
George Felton was a scout.
Okay.
He worked in the scouting department for the Pacers, right? And Chad Forcier at the time was their assistant coach when I was at Milwaukee. Chad Forcier was in Indy. And that's when Indiana started, like, we had the Palace Brawl.
Yeah.
This was prior to all of that. So going into my freshman year, they used to always ask if any of the college guys want to come up and play open gym, because they had all their, like, they're guys who they're trying to look at.
Yeah.
Coming in early to like play open gym, and they wanted to kind of look at them, and they just needed bodies. So I was like,
okay.
Yeah, I'll go play. At the Pacers, Donnie Washington going to be there? Of course I'll be.
Sure.
So like, I go there, and this is my freshman year. I am cooking in open gym. I'm like, I'm shooting the heck out of the ball, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, Fred Jones was there at the time, and Fred was like, young fella, you all right? Anytime you want to come hoop, just let me know. So I'm like, I know I'm doing good. So at that time, like, man, I can compete with these professionals. I'm out there shooting, scoring. I'm using my speed, getting to the basket, floating, all that stuff. So all this, fast forward back to all that. I'm in college. I stayed there. I became good friends with like Ron Artest, Marquise Daniels, and all of them.
Yeah.
Marquise. You know, Steven Jackson, all of them were like good people with me growing up there. So fast forward, the Palace happens. that whole staff gets kind of fired after all that. George Felton gets fired. Chad Forseals gets fired, all that. They get a job in San Antonio. That is the only reason why San Antonio knew who I was.
Wow.
Small world.
So George Felton went to Coach Pop and he was like, hey, man, there's a kid that y'all need to go check. He's under the radar. No one's talking about him. So I went from them coming to watch a kid named Brandon Cole play, and I seen the Pacers on the little scoreboard, like, that's going to be there. I'm like, oh, I got to show out. This is my freshman year. I think I had, like, 25, like, 6 and 7 as a freshman that game because, like, I was so hyped. Like, hey, this is that one shot I said I need. This is the one opportunity, and I took advantage of it, and the rest was history.
And you played for Coach Hunter?
Yeah.
I mean, where's he at now? I mean,
he's Tulane.
Oh, he's head coach at Tulane now?
Yeah.
Okay, because I know he was a coach on the rise. He had a whole thing with
his son.
Okay.
Oh, Ron Hunter.
Yeah, with the shoes or something. It was the shoes or.
It's called Samaritan's Foot. He coaches and gives kids like it's like the shoes for cause. So they coach with no shoes on and try to get donated shoes to the kids in like Africa and stuff.
Oh, good. It's good to hear that he's still involved. And so then, I see you play Phoenix. You turn it out. You wind up going to San Antonio as a late first round pick, playing for Pop. What was your first impressions, your first experiences just in that whole San Antonio system? What makes that so special?
Shit, I was scared at first. I didn't know what to do. I was so nervous because like you say, you're going to San Antonio and you just knew Pop was a military type of guy. So they just came off for a championship the year before I got there. So now it's like the pressure is building on another one. And when I got there, it was like complete opposite. It was very like hardcore, but it wasn't like he's pounding your head, like do this, do that. No, it was detail oriented. It was being on time, being a good teammate, playing for each other, sacrificing yourself, like carrying yourself in a certain way where you're a pro off the court and on the court. Like, those were my things that I picked up from day one. I'm like, man, Tim, Tony, Manu are here 2 months before the season start working, getting familiar with each other, inviting all the guys over to their house, trying to like connect. And the system, I think if I didn't get drafted there, I probably would have been out the league early because it gave me a great foundation of what it is to be a pro.
Did you have a vet? Did you have your own? We always say that George is my rookie. Was there a vet that thought of you as kind of like his special project and kind of took you under his wing a little bit?
No, like I wouldn't say one. You know, like and it's weird. Like the weirdest part for me it was like I didn't have one vet. I had like 12 of them.
Okay.
It was weird. I was the only young guy. We had me and Malik Harrison at the time.
Sure.
We had me, Malik Harrison, that went to Oregon.
Sure.
And then we had James Gist that went to Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
James Gist didn't make it all the way. Malik stayed. We kept bouncing from the G League up and down. But I was the only one that stayed up in the NBA, right? So I was pretty much the only rookie. But then, like, Tim gravitated, like, putting his arm around me. Tony Parker put his arm around me, showed me how to get to the paint, be effective using my floater, how to use my body, how to get into the paint, like little sneak like drives where you grab people's leg and you get around them. And then Manu was gravitating, showed me his stuff. And then we had so many other great pros like Keith Bogan that people don't give a lot of credit to, was showing me how to be a better defender.
Yeah.
You know, Bruce Bowen showing me how to be a better defender. Jock Vaughn showed me how to be just a pro, it's not about me, it's about the team, just whatever the coach needs, just being that guy. Mike Finley was huge for me, like taking me out to dinner all the time. Kurt Thomas was a really, really good one for me. Like, that's probably the closest that I had, him and Mike Finley and Antonio McDice. Kurt Thomas, Mike Finley, Antonio McDice. Like Jock Vaughn, Ime Udoka, Fabrizio Alberto, Tim, Tony, Manu, Bruce. Like, I don't think I could have had one. Like, I didn't have one pro. I had like 12 of them. 12 mentors.
In your experience around the league, is that situation in San Antonio normal for so many vets to kind of take the onus to mentor young players and reach out and really provide that support?
I mean, it was back then. I think now the new generation of basketball is like, we don't need vets. Let's just focus on the young. As you see, there's not a lot of vets anymore on any team. If you do, you have maybe one, maybe two. No one wants that 38, 39-year-old in their locker room like that anymore. They just rather say, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going young, and we're just going to have them learn by experience. Well, a lot of time when you do that, you're not affected because you're having 17, 18-year-olders trying to be professionals and don't know how to be professionals. Especially when the money is so high now, you gave them everything. So the work ethic, like, what am I working for? I've been to work for you. You already gave me $300 million.
Yeah.
To not really work. Where back then, you wasn't getting paid unless you performed in the playoffs. So you had to grind to get something. Now you get paid off of potential. If you're tall, if you're big, if you're long, if you're athletic, you might get a lot of money right now. So it's different now. I think more vets are getting pushed out and we're just going younger, which is cool. Like, that's where the money is. Everyone wants to see the highlights. You know, ain't no vets like that outside of Bron right now doing no highlights like that. So they need highlights. They need the flares and, you know, a veteran's going to keep it minimal, fundamentally sound.
How much of that, George, you think is the reason why this conversation is so prevalent right now about the NBA's popularity dissipating, going down? I mean, how's watching the league for you? And can you put your finger on if you think that there's something that the league needs to do to make it, you know, just more attractive to people watching the game today?
I mean, like, and I say this respectably to everybody in the NBA now. I'm not niching anybody. I'm not talking about anybody because I love everybody's success, right? But real basketball people want to see real basketball. They want to see people playing defense. They want to see physicality. Like, you're not allowed to hit anybody anymore. You're not allowed to, like, check somebody coming through the paint. Like, Mars, you know, we played, or like when you played, and even my earliest career, like when you come through that paint, it was a free hit for everybody. You couldn't go through the paint without getting touched. Now it's like my guy goes to set a cross screen or paint. If I stand the big up from going across just to give my big 1 second, that's a foul on me.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to do that anymore. I can't like put my arm and hit back. It's like it's an offensive generated game now.
Yeah.
I think you're losing people because now it's about the flareness of the game rather than the game itself. We lost the game itself.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm watching the Knicks and the Bucks a few days ago play in New York, and then the very first possession, and I counted, Jalen Brunson took 22 dribbles, and they were calling the game close. So Andre Jackson Jr., great defensive player out of UConn, couldn't touch him, you know, but he's got 22 dribbles to kind of get. He's, you know, I'm like, what, you know, right then it was like, what am I watching? You know what I mean? And I understand he's a great player. Don't get me wrong, I love his game, I love everything he's meant to the game, Jalen Brunson, but 22 dribbles and you can't touch the guy. We used to say, Don Nelson would say back in the day, 5 or 6 dribbles, I don't care who you are. You can, if you're a decent offensive player, you can get to your spot and score on anybody in about 5 or 6 dribbles. He took 22 dribbles from the time he took it inbounds to the time he took his shot. Yeah. So to your point, I mean, and we had Joe Dumars on. And Joe Dumars, he's from the Bad Boy Piston era of the late 80s. So I think he's going to try, George, to bring it back. We're defense now. All the touch fouls, all the guys getting to the free throw line 10, 12 times a game, and most of those are touch fouls, trying to get that and one. He's starting to clean things up. I mean, do you think that's a good direction for the game to be headed in right now?
I mean, for sure. I think it's hard to be an elite defender when you can't touch somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because now, like, everyone's just driving to you, throwing their head back, and it's a foul. It's like, man, is it really a foul? Or if he's going to initiate contact to me, I should be able to hit back.
Yeah.
It can't be like if the offense initiates contact, I have to open my gate and let him go. Like, where's the resistance that I get?
Right.
you try to explain that to the refs, like, hey, if he lowers his shoulder, I'm able to body him up. Oh, no, he has a right to go to A to B. I was like, but then what right do I have from A to B?
Yeah.
And it just, I think it just makes the game a lot harder now, because it's not about the fundamentals of basketball anymore. It's about, now it's like, can we score 140 points? That's what people want to see.
Yeah.
Well, the younger generation, the older generation is like, I want to see bigs be back to the basket and, you know, throwing some jump hooks, some up and under, physicality screen.
Yeah, man.
You're getting pressure in the backcourt. Where's that big coming to lay you down? Like,
yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That's what you want. Like, I think that's what we're missing in today's game. And I think that's why the popularity is kind of going down.
All right, George, Giannis and Tim Duncan, if you can choose one to go to battle with in a tough one-game series, you got to win, who would you pick and why? Talk about the virtues of each from your inside knowledge of playing with both of them.
Are they both in their prime?
Yes, sir. Both in their prime.
Yes, sir.
The height of their prime.
Okay. So, I mean, the two different games, right? I think right now Tim is the greatest power forward of all time. Arguably speaking, right? It's maybe. Everybody says Hakeem Olajuwon this. I'm like, for me, Tim is probably the greatest power forward of all time. His game speaks volumes. I think Giannis is a great job because he's still evolving. Like, he's so young still. I don't think that he's reached his prime yet.
Yeah.
I think once he starts to develop more of the outside, being more consistent with it, I would say look out for everybody. But if I was to take, I don't know, that's a hard
one guy. You got one guy, George.
Hard.
Come on, give us one, George.
I love GA to death, and I think he's one of the biggest competitors I've ever played with. I think his tenacity on both ends of the floor, his will and power to win is impeccable. I just seen Tim Duncan do it in every aspect of the game. And I don't think I can put anybody over Tim Duncan for me. I think we call him the big fundamental for the reason. I think we call him the greatest power forward of all time for a reason. And no matter how good Giannis is, Tim in his prime was.
It's a gold standard. He's a gold standard.
Yes, know? Sir.
He's a gold standard.
Timothy.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't give him credit how good he was defensively.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overshadowed by how good he was offensively.
That's a great point.
So now you were with the Milwaukee Bucks on two different tours of duty, for lack of a better term. It seems like you've always, not always, but a couple of times, you either got to the finals and the team won a championship the year before, the year after. Break that down for us, the near misses, and then has that left a disappointing taste in your mind? I won't say a bad taste, but just to not be able to compete for a champion, not win a championship. You've gotten to the finals, though.
I mean, for sure. I mean, I wouldn't want nothing more than to win a championship there. You know, my first couple of years there was amazing. And even the last year before I left, before y'all won the finals, I really thought that was our year, going up 2-0 on Toronto.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what happened to us. It's like we stopped clicking. We stopped trusting one another. We start trying to just do it on our own, and we lost the momentum. But that was technically our year. We were the best team in the NBA.
Yeah.
We were playing the best ball at that time. It was just like something after we went up 2-0, something like turned off. I don't know what it was, but that happened. And then the next year, you know, I get a call in the middle of the night that I've been traded. And the cool part is they traded for one of my good friends, Drew Holiday, that we've been knowing each other for a long time. And he thought I was still there. But in order to make that trade work, they had to add me to that trade. Mm-hmm. But what he was told was that I was still going to be there as a backup.
Mm.
Wow.
So like when he got traded, he hit me like, yo, because me and Drew always wanted to play together on the teams. We've always thought about that. You know, his wife is from Indy. We grew up together. We always want to play together. And we thought that we can compliment each other well. And he called like, yo, I'm traded to Milwaukee. And I'm like, I'm traded out of there. He was like, no, they said you here. I'm like, Nah, they just called me. So he didn't even know.
Wow.
Damn.
But I'm happy. I'm happy they won. I have no bitterness in myself. Like, came back the next year trying to do it again. Kind of injuries kind of got the best of me at that time. Something that probably a lot of people didn't know, but it just didn't work out so well.
You had a broken neck. You had some kind of thing going on with your neck that people weren't aware of that year, right?
Yeah. So like, I think people just thought I was playing bad. But like, it happened right Christmas, I believe, when we were playing the Celtics. Marcus Smart kind of felt on my neck. And at the time, I just thought it was like, man, he fell on my neck. I probably got like a cramp or something. And I let it go for like a couple of weeks. And I'm like, it'll get better. And it just wasn't getting better. I'm like, maybe I just messed up something. So I just let it keep going. I'm just like, because I don't want to say I'm hurt because I want to play. I want to be there with the E. And then all of a sudden, like a month got into it. And when I turn certain ways, or if I get hit with a screen, or when I was going into my jump shot and my head like kind of looks up quick, I was getting stingers in my neck where it was kind of shooting me down.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't know, like, I'm getting like stingers that you normally get. You know how you used to get them in your shoulder? Like, I was getting it in my neck where it was running down my spine. So it was getting like a shocker through my spine where like I'll be in the middle of my shot and I'll hit it and I'll hit the side of the backboard and I just get back on defense and like play it off. And I'll try to go to the basket and take a hit and I'll just be like, ah. Well, I didn't know when that happened. In my spine or my vertebrae thing, my pads were ruptured and they were hanging outside of my spine.
Mm-hmm.
And it got so bad that like my pinky finger, my ring finger, and my thumb all went numb. Wow. I didn't have no feeling in on my left hand. I didn't have no feeling on all three fingers. So I like finally went to the trainers, like, I don't think this is right. So they rushed me to a neck specialist here, and a football player just had a football player from Atlanta, I believe, was it Julio Jones or somebody like that, just had that same thing and had to get surgery.
Right.
Had to get surgery on his neck. So the doctor said, like, hey, man, your pads in your spine is messed up. They're basically, if I take your spine, I smash it down and I ooze all your stuff that's in the middle, hang out. That's how I was. He's like, it got so compressed that the gel parts are hanging on the outside. He's like, so it's only going to get worse. Only you have two options. He was like, you got to get surgery probably next week. I was like, how long is surgery? So he's like, you're going to be out for a whole year. So that means I would have missed the rest of that half of the year and the beginning of next year. He was like, or we can try something. I don't say it's going to work, but we could try it. We can give you a shot in your neck and you can't do nothing for 2 months. Like, we don't want you to ride a bike. We don't want you to lift weights. We don't want you to do anything. You have to just be still.
Yeah.
No contact. He's like, and then you're going to come back in 2 months. We're going to give you another one and you can't do anything for a month.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, 3 months, a year. Let's try the 3 months. So I did the 3 months and boom, I get back. This is right before the playoffs or something. And I get back and I was just off. I was out of shape, no rhythm. Yeah. But it like took a toll on me. But at that point, everybody thought like, oh, freaking G is washed up now.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopeful. No, I just went through like a neck injury and I came back. And it was kind of like they brought in another guard who was playing really well, and Javon Carter, who deserved, he had a really good preseason. I was still kind of recovering from all of that. And it kind of never bounced back after that.
Yeah. Well, look, man, before we let you go, George, one of my favorite memories is when you had the whole team out to your ranch outside of San Antonio, man, 850 acres of just beauty and outdoor magnificence. But man, the thing that really impressed all of us was that car collection. You still got the car collection? Did you have to? You had to let some go. You add to the collection. And where's it stand right now? And how many cars is it? Tell us a little bit about it.
I mean, it's still there. I haven't added yet, but I'm in the process of working on the Daytona 500 that we're doing. So that's probably is already been like a 2 years in the making. It's probably going to take another year because we have to wait on certain parts, and we want the parts to be like authentic parts rather than remanufactured. So it's trying to track down parts off of a real Daytona 500, which is hard because there's not very many of them.
Yeah.
You know, so like that's a six-figure type of a car.
Wow.
Yeah, like all the other ones still the same. All the Impalas from 58 all the way to 64. The Roadrunners. The
How many cars in the collection? How many cars did you have in that warehouse barn that we took?
20 that are complete, and then I have 15 that are my projects that was on the backside that I still need to do.
Okay. And Chris, you had one car. When you opened up the trunk, there was like a basketball court.
That was my first car. So like, it was high colors, but the trunk, we played homage to like when I got drafted by the Spurs. So like when you open it, if you open it halfway, the top of the trunk has big TV screens like a jumbotron. Mm. It has lights that shoot off on the court. It has a real wood basketball court that has like real gold lines, and all the bleachers are the ants.
That's killer.
So like,
yeah,
that's like my baby.
Yeah, that's what's up, man. So listen, the Milwaukee Bucks, Giannis, Chris Middleton, all your guys, Dame on the team now. What's your thoughts about the Bucks and where they're headed this year? And from what you get a chance to see them a little bit, kind of what's your impressions of the Bucks right now?
I mean, always a fan of them. I think they always have a chance when you got the makeup that they have. You know, you have Dame who can beat you by itself. You have Giannis who can beat you by itself. Chris, when Chris is healthy, is still one of the best scorers in this game. Bobby Portis playing out of his mind when he's playing. You still have Brooke protecting that rim. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they started slow, and I think that was just more of like getting their feet wet, trying to learn the chemistry. Chris not being there, trying to figure out, okay, what's going to be our identity when Chris is not there and all that stuff. And then guys started to gel. Chris came back. Bobby started playing well, and I think they're doing good. They're just a little shaky right now going up and down. But I think the biggest thing with theirs is, can they stay healthy? That's going to be the Bucks. That's their biggest issue, and that's always been our biggest issue. Can we stay healthy and play well at the right time? If they're going into playoffs fully healthy and playing well, they're going to be the team like that no one wants to play.
How you feel about Giannis's mid-range game, man? You been watching that?
Hey, you say you're going to work on it. It's getting a little better.
It's nice.
It rains getting a little better. Like he would say, it's nice.
It's nice. I'm nice. Yeah, you walk good. Was that a good group to play with, man? I mean, just, you know, I know the guy. I've been around him 10 years. But just from being on the inside, just how special was it playing with a crew of guys like that?
I mean, I loved it. I think one of my favorite groups to play with outside of like my indie team and my Utah team. One of my favorite groups. I think people didn't know how close we were off the court, but we were all super close. We all cared about each other's family. We all try to hang out as much as we can, doing dinners together. Even when we were back in Milwaukee, we would, you know, either four or five of us get together, take our kids to play places like together. So like we were really, really close. And it sucks, like when you're on this side now, on the outside looking in, you just miss those days.
Yeah. Are you still doing the thing with the military? You had some great events for military families. You still involved in that?
So we just did one this year. We just did it again. We always done it here in San Antonio also. So we did one in September here in San Antonio. We raised almost $800,000 for military families. So
wow.
That's awesome.
Man, George.
That money stays in their pot for military, man. We don't take a dollar out.
Appreciate that, man. That's amazing work. We appreciate you, man. Look, man, we thank you, man, for coming by. We're going to let you go, man. But, man,
I didn't get to answer all these questions we had. I thought we was about to keep going.
Just learning about your background and learning more about you has just been a real privilege for us, man. And are you officially retired? How old are you now, George? What
38.
Okay, so have you filed your paperwork with the league and all that and shut it down officially, or what's going on with you right now?
No, see, like, mentally I retired.
Okay.
No, physically I retired. Let's say physically. Mentally I haven't. I think retirement is the hardest thing a man that plays sports has to do. It's like, it's the one thing that you try to talk yourself out of, no matter, you know that you're ready, you know that you're done, but mentally you've done it for so long. It's probably like the one and the only profession that you know that you're probably developing to being a pro at the age of six.
Yeah.
You're trying to work your way of being a pro that early. So it's like, physically you're done, but mentally you don't. It's like you want to hold on so tight to it.
Yeah.
So like, physically I'm out of there, but mentally I just haven't done it. I really haven't even thought about it. I just know I'm out of there. Like, I enjoy just having free time now and spending time with my kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds good, man. Look, man, we thank you for spending time with us, man. And always a pleasure. And we'd love to have you back on again at some point in time, man. And just kind of catch up with you.
Well, it's always a special place. I love that place. I love the fans. I love the city. They may not love me as much as I love them. But I want them all to know, like, everything I did it from the bottom of my heart. I gave them all I could. Even the bubble situation, it all came from a good place.
All right, man. All right, George Hill, man, we appreciate you. Thank you so much for stopping by to your district.
From the biggest plays on the court to the comments made in the locker room after, an in-depth recap of every Bucks game in 6 minutes. No more, no less. Bucks in Six provides game recaps for every game. Hear the high-flying dunks from Giannis.
Puts it on the floor, spins down the lane, and plunges it through.
Or the deep threes from Dame.
Dame time has arrived with 107.
Bucks in Six on the Bucks Plus Audio Network. Find it now on Bucks.com/plus or on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
All right, here, District, captain of this vessel, want to thank George Hill once again for showing up today and giving us a lot of great insights into his life, his upbringing, so many good things. Got to get him back because he's got some stories about hunting and safaris in Africa that we didn't even touch on. We got to get into. But now it's time for Chris about that action. And what I have chosen to focus on is passing a basketball and Chris Middleton and the job that he is doing. So now take a look at this first play. Chris Middleton finds Andre Jackson Jr. in the dunker area to watch. Catch, jab, go. Catch, jab, go. You freeze that backline defender, Kelly Oubre. And look at Andre Jackson Jr., Chris, just kind of finding that open area, finding that open lane. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think when you play, especially against the Sixers, I mean, sharing the sugar was contagious all night. Chris kind of started it off, but everybody was kind of in the mode. Bucks had 31 big assists, and the ball movement was just impeccable. I mean, it was really, really good. You didn't have a lot of stagnation. Guys are looking to create. Chris does a wonderful job at his size, too, of moving, getting into space, and then delivering the ball on time.
Yeah, he was a point guard at Port of God High School down in Charleston, South Carolina. Okay, so we'll move on to the next play. It's going to be all Chris all the time because of the job that he did. Now watch the masterful subtlety of Chris Middleton and his ball manipulation. Now watch what he does, Chris. He's going to fake, get that defender out of position, and then make that pass to Dame with the left hand around the defender who had committed himself up in the air.
Yeah, fake a pass, make a pass. I mean, masterful ball manipulation. Yeah, but the left hand. I mean, he's a hooper. That's what hoopers do. Stuff like that. That's when you're locked in, though. But see, that's what I was saying about this game in particular. Like, Chris was coming out trying to dime dudes up. And when you start to get that, like, mood around the team and five guys playing that way, you'll do anything. You'll do whatever it takes, man, to get the guy the ball.
And that's a great defensive play. Is that Maxey? Is that Maxey committing himself? He's trying to commit to that passing lane, and Chris gets him out of position.
He made him look silly.
Rifles that thing around him with the left hand, and Dame, a rare corner three, bottom. All right, let's move on. Next play, Chris Middleton. It's all Chris all the time in terms of his passing in this game. Here's a little two-on-one off this ball screen, and this is what he does really well with Giannis and right here, coming off the screen, that defender's in drop defense. And the key for a defender, Brook Lopez, who does it as well as anybody, will tell you, you got to keep that offensive player that you're guarding, Giannis, in this situation, You got to keep vision of him. Keep him in front of you. You let him get behind you, you see what happens.
Yeah, not only does the defender lose vision, but Chris also does a masterful job of this hesitation move right here. This is his stuff. Right there. If that freezes you every time. There's a clip we're going to see later on. He does the same move. It's a right foot tap. Watch the right foot. Tap, tap, tap. And then he goes and kicks it. I mean, but that's his stuff right now. At his size, coming off an injury, you got to do whatever you can, right, as far as maneuver, movement, shake, to get open, create space and open lanes. And it's not a lot. It's just a tap, tap, tap. And then it's another little dribble and a dime to Giannis.
I got
to
use that to broadcast. Tap, 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 tap,
tap, tap, tap. Look at it. Watch. Tap, tap, tap. Watch it. Watch it.
And that gets that defender's rhythm.
Pop, pop, pop. Yep.
Now watch the defender's left foot. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, tap. Left foot rises.
Ha, ha, ha. No, he's going ha, 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 ha. The whole time. And that's, see, it's a dance. And that's what people mean. But that's what they mean by when it's a dance. Both players are dancing. Chris, leading, the other guy trying to follow, right?
Yeah, trying to follow. Yeah, that's great insight. Great insight. Okay, moving on. Next play, Chris Middleton. Take another look at Chris.
Another tap. But watch another tap. Watch it again. Go back. Go back. I'm sorry, MJ. But I love it because you see that?
Yeah.
Right there. Watch it again. Bubba. Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow. Watch. Hey. Chris. Yeah.
And that little tap, 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 that gets Tyrese Maxey, who's guarding Dame, gets that right foot leading towards Chris.
Man.
Opens up the deep three. Tap, tap, tap.
Game of inches, MJ. Right foot. That simple step by Maxey, boop, gives you that enough inch to where now Maxey doesn't get the block.
Right,
because and that's the subtle nuances of the NBA.
Well, and then the last play, just some good stuff here, the little tap, tap, tap. I love that. Hadn't noticed that with Chris Middleton. Thanks for that insight, Chris. The last play, give and go, old school basketball, Dame and Chris playing off each other, give it up, get it back.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, so –
it's the attitude
for us.
But it's just an attitude. Chris kind of shielding the defender so that there's no, from Eric Gordon, no baseline run out or whatever. But it's just a quick play. You know, both guys on the same page, you know, reading and reacting. Same page. That's what it looks like when you're locked in offensively. There's like that willingness to get things done. Perfection. We're executing with the details with perfection. This is yet another example.
And the other thing that stands out now that I'm looking at it for the sixth or seventh time is we've got it on a loop here, Gary Trent Jr. He's like coming off for a fake dribble handoff that gets the defense confused. Two guys go with Trent Jr. He sells it, and that opens up Dame for that corner jump shot. Look at that. Two guys go with Trent.
It's also the Sixers being a little weird defensively. It's like, how do you just leave Dame wide open? Yeah. Somebody's got to go with Dame. I understand Gary Trent's coming off for that handoff, but somebody's got to go with Dame. Dollar dog.
Well, you see the chagrin on the body language of Tyrese Maxey on that young defender. I don't know who that was, that defensive player. But he's like, man, how you going to leave Dame Dollar open in the corner, bro? Come on, man. Hey, coach, cut this fool. Cut this fool right now. How you going to leave Dame Dollar open, man? Anyway. All right, man, about that action, man, I just wanted to really focus on Chris Middleton, the passing, man. What a great, great show that we had, and the Bucks are playing great basketball right now. Thanks again to George Hill for stopping by. Thank you, Chris Johnson, for your great insights and all this good stuff and about that action. And, man, just got to keep this thing going, man. Keep this thing going. The momentum is building just at the right time, and it's a good time to be a Milwaukee Bucks fan. So.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. We're out of here. Here it is.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production. Thank you.